Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm joined today to discuss Raiders of the Lost Ark by JB.
Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun.
That's the theme music from Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, right? I recognize that.
I was toying with the idea of just humming that loudly for like 10 minutes.
Nice. I would have let you.
And how you would wind up reacting.
I would have sat here and just seen how long you were going to do it. Instead, I had to interject with my great Crystal Skull joke. Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. We post stuff every day. We have podcasts. If you want to find every episode of our podcast, go to fthismovie.blogspot.com, because you can't find them all in the iTunes store. As JB says, the first 26 are collector's items. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. And you can find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com. Click on the movie podcast tab at the top of the page. And while you're there, click on one of the tens of thousands of reviews at DVD Verdict and click the Amazon links to buy something and support DVD Verdict. Why don't you? Thanks to everyone who came out to our screening of Die Hard on August 2nd, thanks to Tug for helping us put that on. Thanks to AMC for hosting us. But yeah, especially thanks to everybody who came out. We had a bunch of people. We had a great time. We got to see Die Hard on the big screen.
Thanks to AMC for getting the hell out of our way.
It was a ton of fun.
And it reminded me that there's nothing like seeing it in a movie, because we did opt for the 35mm print. And I think everyone there who has seen Die Hard multiple times were shocked when you asked for a show of hands of who had never seen it.
It was a lot of people.
I was really surprised by how many people raised their hand. And so we not only got to see it in a real movie theater on 35mm, but in a crowd of people, some of whom had not seen it before and were reacting honestly to just how great that film is.
There were two things in the movie that I had never noticed before prior to this screening. One was, spoilers for Die Hard, after Rickman shoots Takagi, his two of his henchmen are exchanging money as though they had a bet.
Yeah.
I had never noticed that before.
The computer safecracker guy has one line where he refers to it.
Okay.
That they're questioning him, and he says something like, I told you before, he's not going to go.
Yeah.
And I think in the spirit of Trading Places, which we were just talking about, it's like a dollar.
Yeah.
Or maybe a five or a 20.
Right.
Certainly not worth a man's life. The other thing I noticed, besides the fact that the script is really clever and has the patience and gives the audience enough credit to sort of lay the groundwork for things and then have them pay off later.
Without telling you, this is going to pay off, which is what every modern movie does.
It gives the audience credit. And there's a scene where we're up in the higher floors of the building that are still under construction, and there's an electrical panel box that some, in the reality of the film, construction worker has placed a Playboy centerfold on. And the first time they pass it, there was a couple people in the audience laugh. Someone made a reference to, can I talk about this?
Sure.
I heard someone say something very much like, that's for Doug.
I didn't hear that. Are you sure it wasn't Doug who said that?
Maybe it was Doug. We'll have to ask Doug. But clearly I had seen the film before, and I always thought the Playboy centerfold on the electrical panel was masterful.
Yeah.
Because later in the sequence, it shows us where we are,
right?
Because it's unfinished. It's just sheetrock. It keeps, it just stairway upon stairway upon stairway. And they pass that centerfold maybe three or four times.
Mm-hmm.
And every time someone does, we know exactly where we are in terms of the geography of the building. Brilliant.
Yeah. It's such a great movie. And it's probably going to come up again as we talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
When I was thinking about Raiders of the Lost Ark to prepare for this podcast, obviously I still had Die Hard on my mind, and I thought there were a bunch of things they shared in common that I don't notice a lot of modern films bothering to do. We'll talk about
that. Yeah, hold on to that, because I think I'm on the exact same page. JB, have you seen anything good lately besides Die Hard?
Yes. This summer has been a banquet. I think this has been a really good summer.
Okay.
And we did the Year So Far podcast where I was sort of miles away or something. Like, I think I've said this already. I didn't realize Moonrise Kingdom was the new Wes Anderson film. Yesterday, I saw the long trailer for The Master.
Yes.
And I'm now looking forward to that. But this summer shaping up really well. I've enjoyed it. I was upset that The Dark Knight Rises created this hole in the summer schedule where no one wanted to go up against Batman except animated cartoon characters. And so the week after Batman opened, I was like, okay, ready to see a movie. Nothing. Unless I want to see Ben Stiller, which I think is worse than nothing. But yesterday, I finally got a chance to see Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh, okay.
And didn't know much about it. Tried to not read anything before I went in. And it's really magnificent.
Okay.
I'm not going to spoil anything. I think something my wife read before we went said, it is unlike any film you've ever seen before.
Okay.
And it is.
Okay.
For a number of reasons. I thought it was great. I thought it was one of the better films I've seen all year. So real that you keep thinking that maybe it's a documentary, that they're using the realism thing. It's just uncannily realistic in so many ways. Amazing performances by the two leads. It's well worth your time.
Okay, great. I know we had talked about it and it was getting some mixed reviews.
I can't understand that. I had one quibble and it was a very tiny quibble. And I was discussing it with my wife, and she said, this is way too complicated and it gives way too many things away. But she explained how she saw the film being stylized in a way different than I did. And so my quibble would be subsumed by her interpretation of the film.
Got it.
But it's a very tiny quibble. And it's hard to think of another film that's like it. The closest I can come is... lately was Winter's Bone.
Okay.
But it's not like Winter's Bone at all.
Okay. Anything else?
I keep wanting to see Moonrise Kingdom again.
Yeah.
I think I need to see that again.
Okay. I feel like I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum from you regarding this summer. I sort of started out the summer very positive and I was like, "Boy, every week I'm seeing something that's kind of good and interesting." And as the summer has worn on, I'm like, I feel myself deflating, and maybe it's just because we're closer to the end of summer now and the bad stuff is coming out, or maybe it's because movies that I had really high hopes for have let me down, and those are the ones that are sticking out to me. I'm forgetting the ones that I really liked.
And you notice, and I think this is recent, there used to be at least one big one in August.
Yeah.
And it seems like distributors and studios are staying away from August, although I'm very much looking forward to Paranorman.
Yeah.
And perhaps getting ready to be disappointed by that too. But I think the reason why you feel that way is because you go to see things like The Watch.
It might be. Listen, that was for work. And I paid the price. Having said that, I got the opportunity to see Your Sister's Sister, the Lynn Shelton movie, which...
For just a second, I thought he wasn't talking about movies. I was really thrown by that.
That's the... sort of romantic comedy with Mark Duplass and Emily Blunt and Rosemary DeWitt. And I so wanted to like it because I really like those three actors. And the movie does not work. It's one of these, like, sort of, you know how the studio indie, and I think the example that you always point to is Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
It could be this thing or it could be this thing. And one of those is good and one of those isn't. And Your Sister's Sister, unfortunately, ends up being the thing that's not very good. Very frustrating, because, again, I like those three actors a lot. I saw Piranha D.
Double
it's
D?
Not, yeah, it's not 3DD anymore, because on home video it's not in 3D. And what a this is the John Gulager-directed sequel to the remake of Piranha from two summers ago.
Son?
It is, yeah.
Good.
He won Project Greenlight in its last season, and he directed Feast. Did you ever see Feast?
No. I remember that show.
You might enjoy it. Then he made some sequels to Feast that are god-awful.
Another Feast.
Yeah, Piranha D.D. Is god-awful. It's fascinating because it's such a great example of, you know, Roger Ebert has that quote about how movies aren't about what they're about. They're about how they're about it, or something. Mm-hmm. I might be messing that up, but
that's the quote.
Alexander Aja did a remake of Piranha 2 summers ago. That's very entertaining. It's exactly the movie that it wants to be.
Say what you want, it delivers.
It knows exactly what it is, and it works if you're a fan of that kind of movie. And then here's this other thing that tries to do the exact same thing and fails in every single way.
The reviews that I read to a critic said, this has nothing. What were they thinking? This has nothing of the original.
Yeah, it's avoid it at all costs. And then the last thing I'll talk about is a movie that just showed up on Netflix Instant that I had really wanted to see, and that is God Bless America, the Bobcat Goldthwait movie about a man who discovers that he's terminally ill and decides to go around murdering all of the sort of reality show contestants and Fox News pundits and assholes that he can't stand. And it's a great idea for a movie. It's sort of reminiscent of Falling Down, but sort of way more over the top. For whatever reason, Falling Down was a movie that I so badly wanted to see when it came out. I don't know how old I would have been, in my early teens, that I walked, again, this won't make sense to the people listening, but you'll understand, from my house where I grew up to Woodfield 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
I walked there to see Falling Down because I didn't like it, and I still don't.
There were summers where my friends and I would walk to Woodfield, once again, for those of you who don't know our geography. It's a really long way yeah. for children to walk.
Yeah.
And once we walked to the Century, which was on Golf and Roselle.
Oh, geez. Okay.
From Arlington Heights.
Wow.
And that was crazy nuts. And then after the movie, we ran into someone we knew.
Okay.
And they drove us home.
Oh, well, that's good.
Because if they didn't, we would have died. They would have found us next to Golf Road with our tongues hanging out. When this movie was released.
Yes. God Bless America we're talking about?
Again? Yeah. Okay. Bobcat did a little press. And yeah. There was the least amount of, it's on demand. And
right.
It's in one theater.
Right.
And I sense that they were so desperately hoping it would be controversial,
yeah.
but it wasn't because no one saw it.
I feel like it would be a little more controversial if it were released this weekend in light of the shootings in Colorado, because it has a very different tone to it now. I wanted to like it. I wanted it to be this really sharp satire. It's not. It's as though Bob Goldthwait sat down and wrote out a list of things that piss him off.
Right.
And, you know, they're the things that piss us off, too. I agree with him, but didn't figure out a way to communicate that aside from having his character sit around and say, you know what, I hate this. And then they go and shoot that person.
And in an interview, Goldthwait, I read an interview with him where he refuted that and suggested what was really going on was double irony, that when he felt this way, he realized that he was getting upset over nothing, and so decided to satirize an extreme view.
I call bullshit on that, because I was watching it thinking, I think this is supposed to be satire, but I don't know. It would be like,
because the journalist who did the interview, rightly or wrongly, said something like, is it 3 now that he's made, or 4?
4.
Shakes the Clown.
Yeah.
World's Greatest Dad.
Yeah. There was one before World's Greatest Dad about the woman who has sex with the dog. I cannot remember what it's called.
Yeah, it's got a funny title.
Yeah.
That if you look at his oeuvre,
yes,
one can conclude that he's a very miserable misanthrope who hates life.
Yeah.
And so
I think those other three things all have things. I think all those other three movies all have things going for them, though.
I thought Shakes was a hoot.
Yeah. I think there's things to like in World's Greatest Dad. I think the movie that I can't remember the title of.
And you I'm, saw that?
Oh, yeah. I think it has things to say about
Must Love Dogs?
No.
Oh, no. That's
John Cusack.
That's a romantic.
And it's not the, I'm confusing it, too, with the Molly Shannon, Mike White movie, which was Year of the Dog.
Yeah. The dog one has a funny title.
What the fuck is the name of the... Anyway, it has things to say about relationships and things that we keep secret and why when we enter into relationships.
So Goldthwait was sort of answering the question on the defensive because the question was prefaced with, you hate the living.
Well, I was watching it thinking, like, it would be as though Jonathan Swift writes A Modest Proposal to make fun of babies. Like, that's what it seemed like.
That guy sure hates babies.
Right. It's like, okay, so you hate all this shit, and so your answer is, wouldn't it be great if someone shot those people? Like, I don't know. There's not much of a satirical point made there. And the things that he recreates are... He does such a good job of recreating American Idol or the Bill O'Reilly Show or, like, the Bad Girls Club that it's basically just those things with the title change. It's not even that they're so exaggerated that he's satirizing those things. He's just made those things again. I don't know. It was frustrating. Anyway, let's talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
In the words of Nigel Tufnell, there's such a thin line between stupid and clever.
Yeah. It was a frustrating movie. So a couple weeks ago on our Facebook page, facebook.com/fthismovie, we got a request from a listener/reader by the name of David Notaris. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that.
Hi, David.
He suggested that with the impending release of the Indiana Jones quadrilogy on Blu-ray.
Quartet. Or... the movie that you'll keep on Blu-ray and probably toss
just to get the other three
out. Talk about diminishing returns.
The other ones have fans. The second one has fans.
I have no doubt.
Last Crusade has fans. I'm not sure that Crystal Skull has fans.
I was just reading today that the script got its genesis where for 9 hours a day, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and...
Lawrence Kasdan.
Big chill, man.
Please. Dreamcatcher, man.
Would sit in an office and they would throw out ideas. Now, I have a lot of respect for Lawrence Kasdan. Not only did he write this, but he wrote at least half of Empire Strikes Back. So yeah. Way to go, Lawrence. They just sat there and threw out ideas. And that a lot of ideas that got cut from Raiders of the Lost Ark wind up in...
Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that as well.
The Gong and...
The mine chase, yeah, which is a great sequence. Again,
Kasdan wound up with like 100 hours of transcripts, and then had to sort of boil it down to a movie that would work. And maybe we could argue, because Spielberg has sort of gone on record as saying that stuff that you didn't like in Crystal Skull, that's all George. That George and Steve with Lawrence Kasdan, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
George and Steve without Lawrence Kasdan, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, well, then,
which actually recycled something from Back to the Future.
Right,
so,
right.
Just any port in a storm. Well, just what do you want Indy to do? You want Indy to sell you shoes? Indy starts as a shoe. No, I could see his story arc. He's a shoe salesman. He's been disgraced, and then he. One question I've always had is:
yes,
Karen Allen as Marion Ravenswood is such a wonderful. Foil, girlfriend, yeah. Female lead,
yeah.
That I could never figure out why they leave her out of Temple of Doom and decide to go with her opposite. Oh.
Are you sure you can't figure it out?
Well, it makes me sad if that's the reason,
yeah.
Because Marion is smart and funny and strong and just, wow, so entertaining. And then, well, no, we're going to have a ditzy blonde.
Right before, listen, so I didn't finish... David suggested that we do Raiders of the Lost Ark. So we're doing Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Sorry.
But here's the thing. Raiders of the Lost Ark is great. We could do 40 minutes of the Chris Farley Show and just talk about, remember when
Toad's
face melts?
When they're on the truck and Indy is using his whip and it's dragging him.
Do you remember when Indiana Jones hates snakes?
Do you remember when you think there's going to be torture and it's... a hanger for his coat.
Anyway.
That was actually a gag.
Raiders of the Lost Ark is great.
That was actually a gag that they tried out for 1941.
Oh.
And it didn't work. It's in the deleted scenes.
Wow, Spielberg
and
is great.
Spielberg,
the,
he...
Yeah.
Nothing
I'll file
is,
that
no,
away for
nothing,
later.
Nothing
yeah.
goes to waste.
Right before Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, when we were still excited about the prospect of another Indiana Jones movie, we got together and watched the first three movies back to back.
We did that here.
Yeah.
We did that at my house.
And it was the first time I'd seen Temple of Doom in a long time. And Temple of Doom has its fans. Temple of Doom has people that would argue that it's better than Raiders of the Lost Ark. But I had forgotten how much I dislike so many things in Temple of Doom, including Kate, what's her name's performance?
Kate Capshaw.
Kate Capshaw as Andy, which is incredibly shrill and one note. And I think speaks to why Temple of Doom doesn't work as well as Raiders of the Lost Ark, and why Last Crusade doesn't work as well as Raiders of the Lost Ark. Because it takes away Marion, who is great.
I will admit that there are pieces of Temple of Doom that work.
The mind chase.
And pieces of The Last Crusade that work. My problem is that, and maybe this is something that we can give credit to Lawrence Kasdan for, Raiders of the Lost Ark is a very cohesive, clever screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, Temple of Doom and Last Crusade exist as sequences that mm-hmm. are very awkwardly stitched together.
Mm-hmm. And kind of speaks to like what you just said, that there was all this stuff that didn't fit into Raiders of the Lost Ark. So they just became loose ideas floating around. And so
this could be in any movie. Well, no.
And so what happens is then what? Spielberg or Lucas hires those two jokesters who fucking made Howard the Duck, Gloria Katz
and Willard Huck.
Yeah. To write Temple of Doom, and basically says, here's these four things that we couldn't include. Write these into a movie. And so Temple of Doom is sort of born out of that. I don't know.
And if you could have someone reach into someone's chest and pull out their still beating heart, Steve and I talked about this. We think there needs to be another rating.
Which is amazing, watching even Raiders of the Lost Ark, that movie's PG. I mean, there is stuff. In the first few minutes, you have Alfred Molina impaled on all the spears. You have Toad's face melting off. You have Bellick's head exploding. I mean, there's stuff in that movie that would, hands down, be an R rating right now.
See, there's violence that I consider James Bond violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get Dr. No and From Russia with Love and Goldfinger that were made before the ratings board mm-hmm. started their important work. And and those have a certain type of violence, like yeah. James Bond with a machine gun, and he's in the foreground just spraying bullets, and all the bad guys fall down.
Right.
And then, in more recent Bond films, the violence is on exactly the same level, and some of those get a PG, and some of those get a PG-13. To me, it's like kids playing.
Yeah.
Except maybe for Todd's face melting, that might be a little much.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's...
But tell me that's not one of the scenes you remember.
Oh, of course!
Oh, of course! My God!
That's what I remember from Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's the movie where the guy's face melts off. And then apparently to top that, they rip the heart out of the chest. So Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of these movies that, along with like Jaws and Star Wars, sort of gets not a bad rap, because everybody recognizes that those movies are great. But it's one of these movies that's always pointed to as like, that's the downfall of movies, because the 70s were great, and they were so sort of auteur-driven, and all these directors were making all these great, important movies about characters. And then Jaws and Star Wars come along, and they fuck it all up, because they invent the summer blockbuster.
And that is the accepted wisdom in many circles.
But look at the movies that we're talking about. I mean, Jaws and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark did not invent the summer blockbuster as we know it, because Jaws and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark are all completely character-driven, and no summer blockbuster is character-driven anymore. And that goes to what we were saying about Die Hard earlier. Die Hard is great because it's 100% character-driven. It has all of these interesting, fully realized characters interacting and reacting to one another. It's not just a string of set pieces that someone sat down and said, we need a mind chase, we need a heart pulled out of a chest, we need people sledding down a hill on a gong. It's character-driven, and Marion is a character, and Bellick is a character, and what's his name? Brody, Marcus, what's his name? Indy's friend, Marcus Brody?
The Denholm Elliott yes, character.
Is a character, and Indiana Jones is a great character, and so all of the action stems from that. It's not just a list of stupid set pieces.
But I think I agree with you more than 100%, but I think there's another...
Like 105%?
110, my friend. Maybe 111.
Let's not go crazy.
Watching Die Hard the other night and thinking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, I agree with you about character-driven movies, but I think it's something else as well. And once I began to think about it in terms of Die Hard and such, I started to think about movies in the last 10 years, last 10, 15 years, and what you're saying about character-driven movies is correct. But I see something else lacking, too. In Jaws, in Star Wars, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, in Die Hard, there's something that used to be known as business.
Mm-hmm.
There is the plot,
mm-hmm.
and there are events that move the plot, and there are characters, and there are dialogue. But within each scene, there's little things that make it more memorable,
yeah.
a look, a line, yeah. a piece of blocking, that movies don't do anymore.
No.
And I remember in the 30s, now I can't remember if it was Walt Disney or Looney Tunes, but I'm thinking it was Walt Disney. When they were making Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, when they were making Pinocchio, Disney had a standing reward of like $10, $20, $40. There was a monetary sum for any one of the animators who could come up with a piece of business that would make it into the film. And it's those little, I'm trying to think of a small perfect example of this. A little incident or something that doesn't further the plot.
The thing that I always point to in Die Hard.
But embellishes.
Is Al Leong, who's the Asian hitman, henchman, murderer in every action movie from the 1980s.
Yeah.
He's in all of them.
Always with and the he same
plays,
mustache.
Yeah, and long hair. And he plays, you know, henchman number 8 in Die Hard. And there's this one scene where he's waiting to do something that's plot-based. And he looks down and realizes he's standing at a candy counter. And he steals a candy bar.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that it just makes the scene more interesting. It gives him a little personality. Doesn't further the plot.
And it's even split. He's shown looking down into the counter.
Right.
We cut away to something else. And when we come back, he's eating a candy bar.
Right.
The example that I always use, and I like the Star Wars films, but I haven't memorized them. There's a scene where Chewbacca is being led down a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
It's either in Star Wars or Empire. And this little square droid rolls up. Chewbacca roars. And then it goes meep, meep, meep. Mm-hmm. And it sort of runs away like a little scared mouse.
Right.
That's the stuff that makes the movie entertaining.
Right.
Although someone would say, well, whose story arc does that advance? Is that in the first one or Empire?
I don't remember.
But you know the scene I'm talking about.
I do. I remember the scene you're talking about.
Another great example might even be Quint's Indianapolis speech.
Yeah.
From Jaws.
Yeah. That's the best example.
It's probably one of the greatest scenes in the movie.
Right.
But someone might say, for what this does, it's too long.
Right.
But it's terrific, and it informs the entire rest of his performance. I'll never put on a life jacket again. His seemingly psychotic desire to die the way he should have done in the 40s. That
right.
once
right.
he makes that speech,
right.
oh, this guy,
right.
this guy's got survivor's guilt or something.
Right.
And
right.
I miss
but again,
that.
To me, that all speaks to this idea of that it's creating characters. I mean, even the tiniest part now has some sort of personality or has a character to play beyond just I'm Hitman number 5 or I'm this Nazi
the
in
the
Raiders.
The fact that they show Indy teaching his class.
Right.
And he's sort of the opposite of the adventurer in his class. He's
right.
a little bumbling and stuff. And the thing where the female student closes her eyes and she has love you written on her eyelids. Well, how does that it's a little moment.
All
Whatever
these things,
happened to little moments?
And I don't want to come on here just as like
yeah, we
angry.
Don't sound like grandpa.
Exactly. Get off my lawn, Hollywood. But like all of these things have been bled out of not all movies, but certainly these sort of summer blockbuster entertainment movies that we have now, because I don't see how you can necessarily draw a line if you're going to say that Raiders of the Lost Ark is responsible for the Hollywood blockbuster. I don't see how you can draw a line from Raiders of the Lost Ark to Transformers. And Steven Spielberg is involved with both. I mean, that's like that's like blaming George Washington for George W. Bush. Like, they were both presidents, yeah, but that's
George Washington started it.
Exactly.
Like, it all began with him.
I don't know if that's the same thing, guys. So it makes me sad to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I don't want to be the guy who's just like, oh, they don't make them like this anymore, but apparently they don't.
And I also appreciate good dialogue, and while I'm no fan of the Transformers movies, I've seen one of them, and I believe you've seen all three.
Yes, I have.
And perhaps one of our listeners now will pipe up and prove me wrong, but tell me one memorable line of dialogue from a Transformers movie.
Yeah.
And the other night, again, we keep going back to Die Hard, because Die Hard and Raiders seem to be of a piece. For a number of reasons, that while yippee-ki-yay is the famous line that everyone repeats, I'm so impressed by a lot of the dialogue, and I know after the screening, I was saying this to a couple of my friends, how much I love the shot where he's crawling through the heating duct, and he lights the lighter, and in this sarcastic voice, come out to the coast, we'll have a couple laughs. That is such a great line. That is just as good as yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah, but then he also has a line that's kind of bad where he's like, now I know what a TV dinner feels like.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that was a Bruce Willis ad lib.
No, I'm not a fan of that. I'm also not a fan of the several moments where they feel he has to narrate to himself because he's alone so much time.
Yeah.
Think, John, think. Well, no, just show him thinking. Which is another thing I liked about Beasts of the Southern Wild. A textbook example, if you ever wanted to show someone what we mean by show, don't tell. You don't have to say it.
Yeah.
Just show it. The line that I always quote from Raiders, because I teach film study, as most of you know, and for about a decade, I used to take my kids to the International Cinema Museum in Chicago, which is now closed. Were you among the lucky kids who got to go there?
Did we also go to Planet Hollywood?
Yes.
Then yes.
We would get on
also
a bus.
Planet Hollywood also closed.
We would get on a bus
and
go to this International Cinema Museum.
Yeah.
And you'd walk around, and this was one guy's collection.
Yeah.
And he had like an original Edison kinetoscope.
Yep.
And I'm sure the kids thought I was daffy or loony or whatever adjective they're using now, but I would feel like falling to my knees and saying, you know, Edison probably touched this. Thomas Edison probably touched this. And then I would take the kids to Planet Hollywood for some overpriced food. And
they had an original ear from Blue Velvet.
That, my friend, was in Orlando.
Oh, right. I've seen the ear.
Have you heard anything about the ear?
What about it?
Just bits and pieces.
Oh.
That's in the movie. That's in the movie. That's a line in the movie. When Planet Hollywood was a going concern, I was a really big fan of that place.
Sure.
Not for the chicken tenders that were rolled in Captain Crunch.
Which is the only other thing I remember about Planet Hollywood.
Yeah. But Chicago had some unique things. I once wound up in Atlanta for some reason, and Atlanta's Planet Hollywood had a second floor with boatloads of stuff from Ten Commandments.
Mm.
Like some of them were sort of...
Your favorite movie.
No, my least favorite movie. But it's cool to look at the props, and I'm not, right? So anyway, to make a long story really interminable, hard to sit through, whenever stuff like this comes up in class, I always quote Belloc, we walk through history, Dr. Jones. This is history.
Yeah.
And then I'm still capable of being impressed by things like that, if it's truly the historical artifact and not some sort of simulation. I always go back to Belloc,
which again
is a great villain, by the way.
Absolutely, and it's one of these things that Raiders of the Lost Ark actually has like a reverence for history, that it acknowledges that these things are important, and that Indiana Jones' motivation is
pure.
This belongs in a museum, like.
And going back to your original point about how Raiders did not start the summer blockbuster sequence, and here's why. Clearly, we have a supercharged Saturday morning serial. I will grant you that. It's a gee whiz, bang bang, boys adventure.
Right.
But just as you're saying, there's a subtext here that the bad guy is doing this for money.
Right.
And the good guy thinks these things belong to everyone. that's a kind of philosophical heft, even if it's just right beneath the surface and sort of underplayed and not explicit, that's the sort of philosophical heft that is missing from current summer blockbusters.
Absolutely. I, not to keep picking on Transformers, but I think the lesson of Transformers is that, like, cars are cool if you film them a certain way, and girls should look like models. Like, I think that's what you take away from Transformers.
And when I see Transformers, obviously the special effects are impressive, but it seems designed for the guys in high school we called gearheads, because when it stops being a truck and it's a robot,
you can't even make sense of
there's it. There's tens of thousands of moving pieces, and it's an achievement, but to what end?
It's bad. That's a bad design. Right. I mean, it's an impressive CGI creation, but in terms of form over function, it's a bad design because it's overly busy.
In the words of film crit Hulk,
yes,
it is a special effect without purpose or intent.
Right.
A phrase that I want on my tombstone. JB, he lived his life without purpose or intent.
Even as a kid seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark, you could appreciate it, and I was a kid when I saw it, but I loved the movie and I appreciated it without having any frame of reference. I didn't know what a 1930s Saturday morning serial was. I didn't know what the movie was sort of an homage to. But you just responded to how exciting it was and how funny it is without ever being jokey. And that's another thing. Again, I don't mean to keep saying, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark is great and all movies now are bad, because certainly good movies still come out. We had the Avengers this summer. It was very entertaining. Good dialogue, good characters. See? This is a running theme. If you have these things, your movie's probably going to be good.
And I like your point about jokey, because I'm thinking of the scene after Indy's been incredibly beat up. I believe it's aboard the ship, where he's showing Marion where it really hurts.
Right.
And that's very warm and very funny. Right. And then I believe he falls asleep. Right. But I think it comes out of character, not they're having a conversation and he farts or something.
Right. That in so many movies now, the characters make jokes because the screenwriter wrote a joke. You know what I mean? That it doesn't make any sense. And again, to go back to Die Hard, in Die Hard it kind of makes sense because that's the character that they created for John McClane.
He's a smartass.
Yeah, that's his default response to everything. But I saw the remake of Total Recall, and there's all these terrible one-liners that are in there not because this character who's running for his life and is confused about the very fabric of his existence is inclined to make jokes, but just because the screenwriter was like, well, we need a laugh here.
Or, as we've seen from a memorable Patton Oswalt routine, or an episode of Louie, that right before the film went to the cameras, they hired a bunch of second-tier stand-up comedians to punch up the script.
Right.
Also, going back to what you said before, that the film shows us a bad guy and a good guy who aren't just there so that we can cheer one and boo the other, that each one of them believes something different. And if the film is doing its job, we should come to believe that what Indy stands for is what we believe too, and that what Belloc is doing is out of selfish self-interest. But the other thing I really like about Raiders of the Lost Ark, well, there's two things. Number one, very clever to have the bad guys be Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need more films. Here comes a sneeze.
JB is allergic to Nazis.
And this point is nothing to sneeze at. I think we need more films where the bad guys are Nazis, because Nazis are so horrible.
Yeah.
You can do anything to them. So Belloc's head explodes, Todd's head melts, and the audience is like,
yeah, right.
That's what you get. Right. So it's like the minute you make Nazis your villains, it's like, yeah, jam that funnel up his ass and let's melt down that lead. You know, anything
but
again, goes.
And then, but there's a spirit too of Spielberg having fun with that too. And I mean, I think that speaks to, you know, Spielberg's past, his upbringing. Nazis are, you know, or the Holocaust is obviously a theme that runs through a lot of his movies, but this is really the only movie where he really gets to stick it to them, you know, because his other movies, they sort of obviously deal with it in a much more serious way. But this movie is just like, fuck these guys.
And on the same token, because just like Belloc is doing it out of self-interest and Indy is doing it out of altruism, we have the Nazis who see this object as being one thing. And in that great scene where Denham Elliot is talking to Harrison Ford in his house, and I can't say it word for word, but it's this nice little quiet beat where he says, you know, you've never gone after anything like this before. It's terribly, it's like he's letting him know this isn't just an artifact.
Right, right.
That this is someone's religion. And given that it is someone's religion, specifically Christians, and the Nazis are after this thing, I think the same thing about Raiders of the Lost Ark that I think about the movie, oh, it's on the tip of my tongue, Mimi Rogers.
The Rapture?
Yes.
Okay.
That I thought about The Rapture, and that I really thought about The Woman in Black last year, that say what you want, this film has the courage of his convictions, yeah. And it makes, okay, this film is saying, yeah,
right, right.
It's from God.
Right.
And I so appreciate that because I think in our ironic age, a lot of films take the out of, well, was it magic or was it not?
Right.
Perhaps we'll never know. You be the judge and jury. No, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's God.
Yeah.
That's real. Oh, I'm quoting Ghostbusters. Real wrath of God stuff.
Did you see Red State?
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, I don't want to spoil Red State. I didn't like Red State for about 90 minutes. And then in the last 10 minutes, it starts to go this direction where I thought, this could save the movie if he has the balls to do what I think he's doing.
And?
It being Kevin Smith, he does not have the balls to do it. It becomes this stupid little joke.
Have you seen Women in Black yet?
No.
Okay, well then I'll stop talking about it. But again, when it was over, my wife and I turned to each other and said, say what you want, it made a choice.
Yeah, right, right, right. I have not seen The Woman in Black, but I have seen Piranha DD. And so much other
your life garbage. Gone off the track.
Oh, in such a big bad way. Just before we started recording, too, we were talking about Inglourious Basterds because TNT was running it this weekend.
More Nazi villains.
Exactly. And that it subscribes to the same thing, which is just like, Nazis? Fuck these guys.
If it's Hitler, you can show his face being machine gunned into pudding and still get an R.
Right. And even spoilers for Inglourious Basterds coming up.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Coming up, too. The fate of the Christoph Waltz character is somehow so much more satisfying than if they had just chewed him up with bullets. That, and the way that the camera lingers on what Brad Pitt does to him is so weirdly satisfying. And again, that's part of what the movie's about. The movie is about...
And the sound that he
makes...
You
might not be right to be getting satisfaction out of this.
And the sound that he makes. And I would even argue Christoph Waltz's whole demeanor once he figures out what's going on... Well, no, you can't be doing this.
Right.
This is against the rules. And I think it might be my favorite line in the whole film. No, I'll probably get chewed out. I've been chewed out before.
Oh, God, I love Brad Pitt's performance in that movie so much. Anyway, Raiders of the Lost. Do you remember when that boulder chases Indiana Jones?
Here's something I can add to the conversation that I don't think anyone, except maybe a special listener, has ever heard before. When I was going to college, I had a very special film professor. Mm-hmm. I think you've heard me mention him.
Yes.
And I keep wondering if somehow, somewhere in the universe of serendipitous accidents, he has stumbled upon this podcast. And here's this student from 30 years ago talking about film. Because I'm talking about Professor David Desser at the University of Illinois, who taught me everything that I knew, or know, or will know. A friend of his did the animation where they show the map. And
really?
I love movies where they show a map,
yeah.
And then there's an animated line
right.
That shows you. And then there's a dot. So I guess they stopped there for a while. And then change direction and went somewhere else.
I had to be 6 or 7 the first time I saw this movie, and like, I got that. You know what I mean? Like, I hadn't seen it in other movies, but, like, I got that that was a thing.
Later, that would be adopted for GPS and be right. very successful. Yeah, right. You're the right. arrow, and right. there's a line. But believe it or not, today, I was thinking about that, because I remember Desser saying, oh, yeah, a buddy of mine did that animation. They actually paid him very well. And how much I love movies with the map, with the animated red line. And it reminded me of something that, this is going to be the biggest tangent of today. There's a wonderful series on Showtime that is irregularly scheduled. I can not find it. Maybe they did it years ago and now they're just burning them off. David Steinberg interviews comedians.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
No, I don't have Showtime.
It's terrific.
Yeah.
And I catch it maybe once every 3 months. He interviewed Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner separately. And then they cut back and forth. And I'm of the opinion that during a certain point in time, Mel Brooks was the funniest man on the planet, joke for joke, and that the comedy albums he did with Carl Reiner were an essential part of my college days because my roommate and I would just listen to them over and over and over again. I think back then there were three, and since we graduated, they did two more. They're essential listening. During this interview with Steinberg, they both mentioned that since Mel Brooks' wife, and Bancroft passed away, Mel goes to Carl's house a lot. And they watch TV together.
And they make fun of it, right?
Not make fun of it. But again, these were separate interviews that were filmed in separate places and not on the same day.
Yeah.
Both of them said they love to watch made-for-TV movies where someone shouts, "Secure the perimeter!" And that's their favorite. And I began to think, there's so many bad reality shows.
Yeah.
Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks watching TV? That's something I would watch. Obviously, they'd have to talk to each other right. as the show went along.
Right.
I mean, it wouldn't just be them sitting there watching. But that would be the greatest TV show ever. And in the spirit of secure the perimeter, I like any movie with a moving red line on the
back. Got it.
I will watch that.
You know, even in the sequels, you pointed out that like it's a case of diminishing returns, and I'm on the fence as to whether or not I like Last Crusade better than Temple of Doom. I think I can kind of take or leave parts of both. But even the sequels to Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm sorry, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, forget what's so special about Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is that. These two sides that are sort of diametrically opposed, because there's not necessarily, and maybe I'm just forgetting, I mean, I guess in Last Crusade, the guy wants the Holy Grail to live forever, right? And Indiana Jones wants it for historical preservation
or
whatever.
That's a big idea that doesn't work.
No, not at all. But, I mean, even, you know, Temple of Doom sort of loses sight of what these two sides are fighting for.
I would argue that Last Crusade gets way too much mileage out of Sean Connery's charm. And here's something I know you really hate. Because I haven't seen Last Crusade in a while.
Yeah. Last time I saw it was here.
Doesn't Last Crusade begin with a lengthy sequence with River Phoenix
yes.
as the young Indiana Jones?
Yes.
And that sequence is 10 or 15 minutes long.
Yes.
Is everything you hate... about sequels and things,
yeah.
because it exists...
to explain where he gets the whip and the hat.
And that he hates... I mean, it's
right.
it's like a laundry list of...
Right.
Scar on the cheek, check.
Right.
Hatred of snakes, check.
Right, and again,
Indy was the dog, check.
I love the hatred of snakes in Raiders of the Lost Ark, because it's just this neat little character detail of this badass guy who has this one thing where
yeah.
he's so afraid of snakes. And then apparently somebody sat down and said, we need to find out where that started.
And again, in the spirit of something I've been thinking about way too much, David Mamet wrote this amazing essay called Three Uses of the Knife that more screenwriters should read because then their screenplays would be better. That one of the many things that makes Die Hard such an interesting film is that Bruce Willis gets this piece of advice at the beginning of the film about how to avoid jet lag, and he tries it out, and because of circumstances, that gives him this tremendous handicap
yep.
for the rest of the film. And the protagonist has to have a handicap. It can't be too easy for him to get what he wants, or else it's not drama. And in the same vein, we establish that Indy has this Achilles heel.
Right.
And it pays off wonderfully well later on. In any recent film, does the protagonist have a significant handicap?
If he does, and I'm thinking about this as you're talking about it, I'm trying to figure out if it's a case, and I can't necessarily think of an example. I'm sure it has happened. However, every time it does, I can't tell if I've just become sort of more seasoned because I've seen more movies, and therefore more jaded, or if screenplays have gotten just so clumsy, because now there's hardly anything that happens in a movie that you don't automatically just think to yourself, oh, that's going to come up later. Do you know what I mean? Like in Die Hard, when he says, make fists with your toes, it never occurs to you that this is going to
yeah.
affect the rest of the movie. Or even in the beginning, when Ellis, the douche, is like, show him the watch, it's a Rolex, pays off at the very end of the movie, and it never occurs to you that that's going to happen. And I can't think of an example now of what you're talking about, but I'm sure if I could, it's something where I know immediately. I mean, the most recent example, and this isn't necessarily a character flaw, but The Dark Knight Rises, kind of spoilers coming up for The Dark Knight Rises, turn this off for 1 second, where Alfred tells the story about, I have this fantasy where I'm going to be in a cafe.
Yes.
I mean, there's not a person in the audience that doesn't sit there and think, oh, that's going to come up again. And so is it just having seen too many movies and now you're just used to that? Or is it really that screenplays are much clunkier now?
In Dark Knight, when Michael Caine went into that monologue, I almost shouted out loud in the theater. It was a small theater. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah, right.
But I'm thinking about two other things. That in the case of the Avengers,
yes,
the handicap might be, and I'm just spitballing here, that it's an elite cadre of superheroes.
Yeah.
And so their only handicap would be sending the wrong guy in at a certain moment. So the guy with the arrows can't fall down a building and slow himself down and catch Iron Man.
Right.
Better send Hulk in to do that.
Well, more, so,
of,
more so
because each one of them tries to put the kibosh on Thor's brother.
Right, right, right.
And each one of them sort of gets a chance
right.
with different results. So none of them have a handicap. It's we just have to figure out the mathematical formula of having Black Widow do this
right.
and Iron Man do that.
Of having Black Widow shoot guns. More so, you know, the handicap more so of the Avengers, especially before that climax, is that they can't get along. You know, that's the big handicap.
And the thing that I always point to, and I'm sure I've talked about this before on the podcast and something that drives me crazy, the reason why Die Hard is good drama and Jaws is good drama, great drama, and the reason why Raiders is good drama is because the protagonist does have this handicap. You go see films, and the one I always point to is Van Helsing,
mm-hmm.
where I don't see what anyone's handicap is. And so they start punching each other into walls, and then that person gets up and then punches the other one into a wall, and then they punch back and forth until they're stopped, because certainly no one can die because it's halfway through the movie, but even at the end no one can die because
right.
we're already planning to make a sequel, so there's nothing at stake.
But I've also brought this up a bunch of times, and it's not even my point. The guy from Red Letter Media did this great takedown of The Phantom Menace. It's very popular on YouTube. And it goes on way too long, but he makes a point very early on.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah. He makes a point very early on that applies to most movies that come out. And he's talking about the difference between the original Star Wars movies and the prequel trilogy. And he says, you can go to anybody on the street and ask them to describe any character from the original trilogy, and they'll come up with a bunch of adjectives. And then you do the same for the prequels, and you say, you can't use their name, and you can't say what they look like, describe these characters. And you can't do it because there's nothing to them. And Van Helsing, if you can't say, well, he hunts monsters, because that's what he does, that's not who he is, I couldn't tell you one thing about that character or
he's
the Kate Beckinsale character.
He's a disposable, interchangeable video game character, which was particularly galling to me because in the original Universal Studios universe, Van Helsing stands for something really, really important.
Yes.
He's a man of science who everyone thinks is a crackpot, but if we go with him and believe in him and do what he says, we can vanquish evil.
Right.
Which is something we want to do, at least if it was back in the 30s.
And the same is true of John McClane, and the same is true of Indiana Jones. If you said, describe these characters, you could write out a list of character traits that these guys have. And you can't do that for the kid from Transformers or
Van Helsing. And Indy and John McClane are not perfect, and not just because the vagaries of the plot handicap them. McClane might not have handled the situation with his wife very well. We have evidence of that. Certainly something happened, and Indy left Marion behind.
Yeah. And the movie sort of points out, like, I was a kid, you took advantage of me, and doesn't necessarily... If that movie came out now, that would never be allowed. By three-quarters of the way through the movie, we would get the real story. Well, Marion, I had to, because this and this and this. Because he couldn't be a bad guy who maybe took advantage of a young girl, but... Raiders of the Lost Ark leaves it alone.
Because, God forbid, because in that one column I wrote about directors going back and revisiting their work, I pointed out, and this has been talked about endlessly, the whole Greedo shoots first thing, but it's important in the first movie for Han Solo to be a lovable rogue in the worst sense.
Right.
Because if he's not... His redemption at the end means nothing. He was always a stand-up. No! It's about someone who's not a stand-up guy becoming a stand-up guy.
Right. That's drama, when a character changes through the course of events. God, it's so depressing. A couple of years ago, 2006, I guess it would have been, I got to see a 25th anniversary screening of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that was the first time I'd ever seen it in a theater. And the movie's great. And I was with a group of people, and I will not name names. At one point, about halfway through the movie, one of the people in my group, who isn't necessarily like a movie person, but I would, you know, she sort of represents the typical audience member, I guess. The person who goes to movies every once in a while, not the person who's listening to a podcast or reading our website or whatever. Got up and just walked around the lobby of the theater. Because she had grown restless and a little bit bored by Raiders of the Lost Ark.
At Raiders of the Lost Ark's glacial pace.
And, I mean, I grew so disillusioned with humanity, and I point to that story a lot because that's the audience now. The audience is bored by Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And that's interesting. Oh, so maybe the stuff that I was bemoaning the loss of, the little character moments.
Boring.
Well, that's just downtime.
Too much talking.
Now, when you saw that screening,
yes,
that was at the Music Box.
Correct.
And certainly not the night you saw it, but I guess it was 2006. This would have made my son and his friend 16 years old. We went to the Music Box to see Raiders again with my son, who I believe had seen it, and a friend of his who had never seen it.
That's excellent.
I'm always proselytizing. Needless to say, he loved the film, but the thing I remember most from that evening is he had never been to a theater before, like the Music Box.
Oh, sure.
And he just went on and on about, oh, this is so cool, and why aren't more movie theaters like this? And it was great. I think it was 2 months ago, the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove, which has been doing wonderful things lately, showed Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a brand new 4K print. The ushers and the people behind the candy counter dressed up. They had an incredible crowd, and it was so popular that now once a month they do a midnight show on Friday, and they have since done Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Jaws, which I attended, and they actually decorated the lobby for that with fishnets, and I like when the theater...
Sure.
Because they knew in advance that a film like Jaws would get a big long line. The manager was asking film trivia questions in line, and if you got it right, you got a little prize.
Nice.
Always nice. And just last weekend, they showed Back to the Future.
And as you pointed out, there's a number of theaters in the area that have started doing, just every once in a while, sort of repertory screenings. But they're showing the same five movies.
And the Century Landmark downtown has started midnight shows.
Oh, yeah?
And last week, I'm going to forget this, last weekend was RoboCop.
Okay.
And the weekend before that was It's the Ten.
Right.
It's the films that are going to become the Ten.
Right.
And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the podcast before, but obviously I'm old school and I'm sort of on the fence about film projection versus digital projection. I was really glad we showed a 35mm print of Die Hard.
Me too.
But then last Christmas, I finally went to the Christmas show at the Music Box and saw the single most beautiful print I've ever seen of White Christmas. And I was like, well, now I can't be a hypocrite and say that beautiful thing that changed my life, pshaw. But again, my fear is clearly everything's going to be digital. But once that happens, are the studios going to spring to transfer older films to this 4K resolution that's so nice? And or will we get, there'll be 20?
Right.
Okay. You can see Casablanca, Raiders of the Lost Ark, two James Bond films, you pick, Back to the Future, just the, you know, the 10, and that scares me.
Right. What happens to something like the Music Box Massacre that we go to every year, where Rusty Nails shows film prints of, you know, some pretty obscure movies as these things start to age and break?
I began to think,
he showed a new print of Phantom of the Paradise a couple years ago, right? One of my favorite movies of all time. That goes away because we don't get a digital scan of that movie, so I can never see that again.
And I was thinking about this the other day, and obviously I've been thinking lately, the Northwest Chicago Film Society, which does screenings every Wednesday night at the Portage. Go check it out. They're doing some great work.
This entire podcast is only for people in Chicago.
Yeah, sorry we're being so local. They take pride in the fact that they use only film, and they go to different film archives and also prints that are in the hands of private collectors. So I began to think, in light of the digital revolution, are these film prints going to become like books in Fahrenheit 451?
Right.
Oh, you want to show the Marx Brothers and Animal Crackers? Well, I have to introduce you to Max. Max has the last print. Yeah. You know, in Fahrenheit 451, there's those cool people who memorize the books. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Because if film preservation...
Just like in the Book of Eli.
If film preservation has shown us anything, these things are much better off in the hands of people who love them than in the hands of the studio. And I know the studio has the legal copyright, but the studio's not going to do something unless it monetizes their asset. And that might lead to us having 15 movies from before 1985. Or maybe the thought is, well, theatrical distribution is one thing, and everything else will be on Netflix or some form of Netflix.
Right.
Everything else you can stream wirelessly.
Right. So we hope you enjoyed our conversation about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And why we're not happy. We're... And I don't even mean...
I'm going to change the title of this podcast. This podcast is just going to be called Wah!
And when I say we're not happy, it's not with film at all. It's with our lives. It's with the world in general. We're not happy people.
I forgot to say at the beginning of the episode, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to always check out our website, fthismovie.blogspot.com. Thank you guys for listening. I wish I had a quote.
I would say something pithy, but my face is melting. Ah!